From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, commonly known as NATO, is notorious for its military intervention around the world in the past decades, from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya to former Yugoslavia, with millions of people falling victim to its operations. NATO's eastward expansion has caused growing frictions with Russia recently, a plan that Moscow regards as a threat to its existence. And now, with the current conflict between Russia and Ukraine, NATO's stated goal of maintaining peace and security on the international stage has come under question. Now, this edition of Spotlight will take a look at NATO's past and current positions, its failures and challenges, and try to figure out to what extent it could be blamed for the current crisis in Ukraine. Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's see who's going to join us in this edition of the Spotlight. We'll have David Swanson, director of The World Beyond War from Charlottesville. Also joining us will be Mike Harris, editor of The Veterans Today in Phoenix, Arizona.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show. Now, David, to begin with, let's take a look back at history. NATO was structured around anti-Soviet aims some 70 years ago, as you know, to contain threats from the Warsaw Pact and the Communist bloc. Now, with the collapse of the Iron Curtain after 1989, many predicted that NATO would disintegrate, but it didn't happen. Why?
Well, you know, the Warsaw Pact has been gone for 30 years, and that was the moment for NATO to be dismantled and shut down. It obviously wouldn't self-disintegrate. Someone had to do it, and the courage and the sensibility were not there. In large part because the stated purpose was to keep Russia out, keep the United States in, and keep Germany down. And those two goals of keeping the United States in Europe and keeping Germany down didn't go anywhere. And there was a fortune to be made in selling weapons to Eastern Europe if NATO could expand. And so promises were made, let Germany reunify, NATO won't expand an inch eastward, and the promises were broken. When Bill Clinton was president, you had three countries added. When George W. Bush was president, another seven, and two more countries each for Obama and Trump, with no end in sight.
Okay. Now, Mike, let's review some Bashnita operations around the world. Let's start with Libya. Then U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said that NATO was responsible to enforce a no-fly zone and to protect civilian lives. But on the ground, what happened was that the mission turned out to be aimed at regime change, and which, as you saw, brought chaos to the country, not democracy. And it's still, you know how things are in Libya. So let's have your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, Hillary Clinton has been a very destructive force within U.S. politics for a very long time. She seems to have the fecal touch. Everything she touches turns very bad. So that being given, what happened in Libya was a crime against humanity here, where they went in and destabilized a regime that was promoting peace and wealth and prosperity throughout Africa, putting out the African currencies on a gold standard, which threatened the Western banking interest. That is the one thing that no country is allowed to do, is either resist or threaten banking interests of the West. So that's why Libya was destroyed, and that was an unmitigated failure. In addition to which, there's great support for the speculation that Hillary Clinton and others within the U.S. Department of State were trafficking weapons through Libya intended to be put into Syria to topple the Bashar al-Assad regime. So there's a lot of hijinks and a lot of U.S. Exploitation of other countries going on out there, where the U.S. wants to destabilize these up-and-coming regimes and topple them, bring chaos in so that they can't organize and can't form any sort of cogent resistance against them. Then the resources of that country are laid wide open for any U.S. company or any Western company that wants to come in and exploit them. So really, this is very financially oriented, and it's really piracy by sovereign states. And that's what the U.S. has been doing for some time. And NATO is essentially a tool of the U.S. State Department. Mm-hmm.
Now, David, we can also mention NATO-led operation in Afghanistan, you know, which have in most cases resulted in the killing of a large number of civilians and failed to achieve its goals. And Western forces left Afghanistan in a humiliating way, and they left a legacy of simply further misery for Afghans. Your thoughts on that?
No question, and ongoing, and being exacerbated, and many, many men, women, and children threatened with starvation due to the theft of funds. This is a problem that needs addressing immediately. NATO, in the minds of many people in the United States, is some sort of an international body, vaguely like the United Nations, which they've vaguely heard of. And so there's this idea that if you have a large enough gang engaged in a crime, it's sort of legalistic-ish. And so the United States loves to call wars NATO wars rather than U.S. wars, and can persuade people that therefore they are legal and acceptable and respectable. And of course, this is not the case. NATO is the very madness that created World War One. NATO, NATO now engages in these, you know, foreign imperial wars and destructive pseudo-humanitarian bombings. But NATO, what it was supposed to be, when people say get NATO back to its original purpose, it was supposed to be the madness that created World War One, the agreement to jump into any wars that any other NATO members get in. Which is, of course, why NATO doesn't actually want Ukraine in NATO anytime soon, and why no country has the right to join NATO, because you don't have the right to compel a bunch of other countries to join in all of your wars. And when you not only was NATO used to go after Libya, and not only does NATO shield the U.S. Military from investigations by Congress when Congress finds the spine to do any such thing, because they just passed the buck to NATO, but the lawyer that President Barack Obama used to sell Congress and the U.S. public on the legality of attacking Libya appeared yesterday at the International Court of Justice to represent Ukraine, arguing for the illegality of Russia attacking a sovereign state. Mm-hmm. Russia didn't show up, by the way. So the hypocrisy, it could not be more stark.
Okay. Now, Mike, let's turn to the former Yugoslavia and see what NATO did there. We have reports of, the bombing killing 500 civilians there, infrastructure in ruins, schools, hospitals were razed. Also in Kosovo, the bombing lasted 3 months before the war came to an end. The legitimacy of NATO air campaign in Kosovo has been questioned, so has the number of civilian casualties in there. And also we have the UN International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia establishing NATO's use of depleted uranium and cluster bombs in its military intervention in Yugoslavia in 1999.
Well, the U.S. has a history of using depleted uranium in Iraq as well, particularly in Fallujah. And as a result, that area is going to be the quality of life that's possible there, capable there, has been greatly depleted. The same thing going for Kosovo. NATO is really a U.S. proxy. U.S. calls the shot. U.S. pays the bill. Remember Donald Trump coming out and saying that the NATO countries aren't paying their fair share. They've got to pay their fair share. Remember Donald Trump also calling for the dissolution of NATO, because the whole mandate of why NATO exists was to contain the Soviet Union and their westward expansion. NATO was there to stop that. Well, the Soviet Union doesn't exist, and there are elements within our State Department, particularly Zionist elements, that wish to recreate the Cold War situation that we had back then, because that was good business for them. It's not good for the American people. It's not good for the people of Europe. The real elegant solution to what's going on now is to dissolve NATO and invite Russia and Ukraine both into the EU and make it sort of a more of a commercial pact versus a defensive pact. So there's many eloquent workarounds here. But, like I said, NATO has been out of control for some time and has been acting as a U.S. proxy. And it's time to hold the U.S. State Department and our government officials, who proceed through multiple administrations, and hold them accountable for what is in the best interest of the American people. That is where our Department of State seems to have lost its way, and they seem to be serving another master, which is not what we're set up to do as a country, how our republic is organized. But we seem to be more of a vassal state for a little small sliver of a country down in the eastern Mediterranean someplace that has an inordinate amount of influence over all of American policy. And this has got to end. It's time for this to stop. It's time for the United States government and all of its many iterations to come to serve the people who put it in power and who fund its existence, and get an America First agenda and not be a foreign policy tool for that little small country over there in, we call it Israel. Anyway, Palestine's the real name. Mm-hmm.
Now, David, General Galvin, former commander of U.S. European Command of NATO, told U.S. Congress that 150,000 U.S. troops will remain in Europe indefinitely for two purposes: to counter ethnic and nationalistic eruption in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet republics, and to be available for rapid deployment outside of Europe to counter a, quote, uncertain enemy. What does this signify? That NATO should always have an enemy, certain, uncertain? They need to create enemies in order to justify their raison d'etre?
Absolutely. There's very much of a self-fulfilling vicious circle here. You cannot have this level of weapons sales, this arming of the globe without enemies. Enemies are absolutely essential. And NATO is becoming a global imperial alliance of weapons customers, of largely U.S., but also French, U.K., other big weapons-producing countries' customers. NATO not only has all of these countries in Europe pushing ever eastward, but has these alliances with numerous other countries, potential future NATO members, and countries that are nowhere near the North Atlantic that are partnering with NATO. And this is seen, again, by a lot of people as somehow making things more legal, whereas this is not the United Nations. This is not a democratized United Nations. This is a military alliance. And you have people in the United States, from top politicians to academics to ordinary, who will say, "What, would you abandon the world? Would you ignore and avoid and isolate the rest of the world rather than be in NATO?" As if a death pact, as if a war pact were the only way to associate with other countries, as if you could not associate with other countries nonviolently, cooperatively, legally, as if you couldn't work on the problems we have no choice but to face, the environmental and disease and refugee and nuclear threats, rather than a military alliance that generates the problems, as in Ukraine, that it then claims to need to step in and solve.
Okay. Well, now, let's take a look at what's happening today, Mike. This Russia-Ukraine thing. And Russia has cited its own concerns, NATO's eastward expansion. It's been warning time and time again, but this is what happened. So how justified in your opinion, are Russia's concerns regarding NATO's expansion and activities?
Well, in my opinion, Vladimir Putin and the Russian position on Ukraine, as well as the ongoing expansion eastward, is spot on. The U.S. caused the problem in Ukraine when Victoria Nuland spent $5 billion U.S. tax dollars to topple the duly elected, legitimately elected Viktor Yanukovych regime. And so since then, that's when these dominoes started to fall that's led us to this situation here. And this talk about allowing Ukraine into NATO is absurd, because James Baker made promises to Gorbachev that there would be no eastward expansion toward the Russian border. And then, of course, NATO and the U.S. broke every promise they've ever made. The bottom line is that the U.S. has become the villain of the world. And everything that they say is you can't trust them. I mean, our friends can't trust us. Our enemies can't trust us. So any word that they make, any commitment that they give, is not to be believed. They're there to be, as Reagan said, trust but verify. No, don't even bother to trust the U.S. because they will betray you. They betrayed Saddam Hussein. They betrayed Manuel Noriega, who were both allies of the U.S. And they threw him under the bus. And the other guest, Mr. Swanson, was really correct. He's hinted around something. And that is, after World War II, the U.S. Defense contractors, the providers of these defensive and armament systems and platforms, they enjoyed making huge profits. They enjoyed it a lot. So they've engaged in ongoing war, ongoing skirmishes, ever since the end of World War II. I mean, we're out of World War II a couple years, and there's Korea. Then out a couple years, and there's Vietnam. With the event of 9/11, they created the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. These companies have so much influence over U.S. policy, and they consume so much money through military spending that it is obscene. And the U.S. needs to wean itself off of the defense as an industry, as a national export here, and come up with something that is much more productive. Maybe retool these defense contractors for exploration of space, for instance. There's more money in that than there is in destroying life on this planet and destroying other countries. So the U.S. population has had about enough of this criminal regime that is in power now, and not just the Biden regime, but going back to George H.W. Bush, egregious mistakes have been made that damage American interests and damage the position of the American people. And they've lost the support of the population. That's as simple as I can put it. This country is really in trouble right now, and we're tottering on, open civil unrest. And I'd like to avoid that, but the U.S. government has got to stop its expansionist, imperialistic adventures overseas. And I never thought I would be the one to use the word imperialist, because I've always been virulently anti-communist. And for me to say these words and to see what the U.S. government is doing, it's really been an eye-opener for me, and quite humbling, that the U.S. has got to stop what it's doing. It has to be a better global citizen than what it's been for the last 30, 40, 50 years, actually 70 years since the end of World War II.
Okay. Now, David, let's take a look at the reasons why NATO has been refusing calls, and some very desperate calls, as Zelensky was talking to the House of Commons in the U.K. today, to act against Russia. Is this a sign of weakness on the part of NATO, as Kiev puts it?
First of all, let's be very, very clear. Nothing can justify or make reasonable Russia's invasion and attack on the nation of Ukraine. Yes, Russia had perfectly reasonable demands for months leading up to, and NATO and the United States and Ukraine refused to meet them or even take them seriously. But that does not begin to justify mass murder, which is absolutely inexcusable, no matter who is engaging in it or why. Russia now has quite reasonable demands, and Ukraine refuses to take them seriously or to talk, and Zelensky rather nonsensically acts as if Russia is refusing to negotiate, while he himself refuses to say anything specific to suggest the possibility of meeting any demands or making any demands of his own. So, again, you have to have an enemy, and that enemy has to be an irrational madman that you can't talk with, Otherwise, you're going to have to talk with him or her or them. Right. You know, so this is the problem with the U.S. and Western influence on Ukraine and the position of the Zelensky government. There does not seem to be openness to anything other than escalation, and this risks nuclear apocalypse.
Now, Mike, let's turn to some prediction. What's future holding for security arrangement, especially in Europe and for NATO, given the fact that, you know, France and some other countries have been pushing for, you know, creating this European army? So what's going to happen to NATO?
Well, first I have to disagree with the other guest on one point that he made, that mass murder by the Russians of the Ukrainians. Understand that most of the Ukrainian people are of Russian descent and are very similar to the Russians who are coming in. They share a common language. They share a common genetic. I think Putin and the Russian armed forces have done an inordinately good job of trying to avoid civilian casualties. And so I want to disagree on that small point.
But about stop the future, bombing them. You'll avoid them altogether.
Well, no, I think you're misreading this here, and you know, I appreciate your perspective. However, I disagree with it. But the U.S. would not tolerate China putting something on the Mexican border. Russia should not tolerate, because you know, the road into Moscow is right through Ukraine. So I think they have legitimate self-defense interests there that Putin is defending. Now, there is the issue here where the Ukrainian borders have never been articulated or defined. Going back to 1991. So there is a claim to be made that that is Russian territory still. And so there is a number of issues here. But to answer the question about what the future looks forward to, I kind of see that the Russians have the superior position right now, because they can shut off all the oil and gas into Europe, and the Germans and many others are going to have a very long, cold winter. It's going to shut down their economy. It's going to shut down their industry. So there's a lot of other cards and a lot of other levers that Putin can use that don't require any military actions at all, like the SWIFT system. If they're going to cut Russia out of the SWIFT system, then expect the oil and gas into Europe to go off, and for life in Europe to get very, very tough. But these are all escalations, and what we need to do is de-escalate the situation to avoid the situation. And from what I understand, the Russian view on this is more of a police action to remove the corruption from Ukraine that the West has put in there. Like I said, Victoria Nuland toppled the duly elected government and allowed Western, you know, corrupt interests to come in there. Look at directly at Joe Biden and the millions that have been paid to his son through this Burisma thing. Biden wants Ukraine destroyed so he can destroy all the evidence of his bribery and everything else. Understand that Ukraine is the global nexus now for drug trafficking, for human trafficking of both women and children, and for arms trafficking. And so you understand these things. You understand the criminality, the corruption that exists in Ukraine. And if I was Vladimir Putin, I wouldn't want that next to my country either. So I think what he's doing is trying to protect the Russian people of Ukraine, as well as protect Russia proper. And so I don't support violence. But I do support his position.
Except for the violence that you support.
Okay, unfortunately, that's all the time we have, gentlemen. Sorry for jumping. And let me thank our guests. We had David Swanson, director of the World Beyond War in Charlottesville, and Mike Harris, editor of the Veterans Today from Phoenix, Arizona, for their contribution. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the importance of having halal sustenance. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the importance of the halal sustenance in the Islamic lifestyle. What we see in the Islam and what we see in the Quran is that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given many examples in the Quran and obviously in the Islamic stories, we have these examples that are related to the halal sustenance. We mentioned that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala made forbidden for the Prophet Moses to have milk from any wet nurse other than his own mother. And it was the effect because the mother of Musa alayhi salam or the Prophet Moses alayhi salam was a mu'mina, a believer. And therefore, she was very much careful about the sustenance and food which she used to have for herself and the kids. And therefore, that's why we can see like from such a mother, we have such a prophet. Therefore, Allah has made this important for the Moses alayhi salam to have the breastfeed from her own mother. And therefore, we can see even Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has says that this was because of the mother of Moses alayhi salam, that he was, the Musa alayhi salam was breastfeed by his own mother, that we can see that the time when he had the appointment, the time of appointment, meeting Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and to talk to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on the mountain of Thur, we can see that before meeting that, it was a 2 days walk or the distance of the place where he was and the mountain of Thur, it was a 2 days traveling and he ran towards the Thur without eating and drinking anything and without resting. Why? Because he loved to meet Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And therefore, it is because when he was a child, he was breastfed by his own mother, which was halal and tayyib. And that was the effect that Musa alayhi salam, when he was going to the mountain of Thur, he ran for 2 days without eating and drinking anything in order to meet Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the importance of the halal sustenance. What we can see is that in the Islamic lifestyle and in Islamic teaching, it is important to have the halal sustenance. And the way Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave the example of the Prophet Moses in the Quran, it shows us that it is very important because for all the prophets, Allah has made this halal sustenance important and he made them obliged to have the halal sustenance. On the other hand, what if we do not have a halal sustenance? What if someone has the forbidden sustenance or haram, for example? Therefore, we can see in the Islamic teachings, for example, from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, it is said that if a person eats a bite of the haram sustenance for 40 nights and the 40 days, Allah will not accept his prayers and the supplications. Now, how this happens? It happens because the things that we eat, if it is haram, it has effect on our body. When this body has something which is from haram, which is from forbidden, then when I pray, this prayer will not have that effect when my body was pure from the forbidden things. My supplications, because it has effect on my soul as well, when I do supplications, it will not have that effect what it used to have before this. Therefore, if a person is even taking a single bite of a haram or the forbidden food, it is said that for 40 days and 40 nights, his prayers are not accepted. But remember that this does not mean that a person who is involved in haram or forbidden things should not pray thinking that it will not be accepted. That is an obligation. You must pray 5-time prayers. You must do your job which has been said to you. But on the other hand, get rid of these haram sustenance. Get away from the haram sustenance, inshallah. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Joint statement by the diplomatic missions of the Western countries in Islamabad has created an uproar in Pakistan. The statement posted on the social media platforms presses Pakistan to condemn Russia. The statement was signed by the envoys of European countries and endorsed by the US embassy in Islamabad. The move by the Western diplomatic missions here has drawn strong reaction from the Pakistani government. The Foreign Office has summoned the envoys of the Western countries to tell them that issuing public statements against the host country is not in line with the diplomatic protocols.
On Sunday, Prime Minister Imran Khan doubled down on the European ambassadors and made it clear that Pakistan is not their slave.
I want to ask the European ambassadors, did you write such a letter to India? What do you think of us? Are we your slaves, that whatever you say, we will do?
Pakistan has maintained a fine balance in the ongoing conflict between Russia and the West over Ukraine. The reason Pakistan refused to condemn Russia stems from its growing ties with Moscow.
But the only thing that I can say from Pakistan's government perspective, that Pakistan wants de-escalation. Honestly, Pakistan wants end of the war or end of bombing or end of aggression anywhere for that matter in the world.
Pakistan has remained in the Western camp for decades. that now wants to diversify its foreign policy options. It was because of this reason that despite pressure from the West, Pakistan abstained from the voting on a resolution against Russia at the UN General Assembly session. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Under the title, The Detention of Fuel Ships as a U.S. Decision and Our Choice is Yemen's Hurricane Operations, thousands of Yemenis took to the streets of the capital Sana'a and other cities to protest against the Saudi blockade imposed on the country.
The Yemeni people today came out to send a message to the world that they will not sit idle against this stifling siege backed by the U.S. and enforced under the supervision of the U.K. and members of the Saudi-led coalition. The siege is aimed to bring the Yemenis to their knees.
The protests are taking place amid the worst fuel crisis in Yemen since the beginning of the war, as Saudi Arabia keeps seizing Yemeni oil vessels despite obtaining entry permits by the UN. The long lines of people queuing at fuel stations in the capital Sana'a have reached 4 kilometers for the first time.
The Saudi-led coalition continues to seize Yemeni oil ships amid the silence of the United Nations. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council overlooks the violations of Saudi Arabia and its allies. We call on the international community to look at Yemen as it does with Ukraine and to stand by the millions of Yemenis who have been suffering for 7 years.
Recently, Saudi Arabia tightened the siege it imposes on Yemen and led the war-torn country to a harsh fuel shortage. This has pushed the healthcare system to the verge of collapse, threatening the lives of millions of Yemenis, including children.
Protesters hold the U.S. responsible for supporting the Saudi detention of oil ships, saying Washington is a major partner in the war against their country. They believe that the Yemeni army operations against Emirati and Saudi territories, especially those against Aramco facilities, are the only way to lift the siege. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
In a historic and surprising decision, the European Union has decided to give refugees from war the instant right to live within the bloc and freely travel. They also have the right to work. They even now have rights to housing and medical care. There is one catch. This only applies to Ukrainians. These rights are not being extended to refugees from Palestine, Yemen, Syria, Libya, Afghanistan, Iraq, Mali, the Central African Republic, or any of the other countries in which Western armed interventions provoked refugee crises. Seemingly no one would begrudge Ukrainian refugees their human rights, but many in France are wondering why they are getting treated totally differently from black, brown, and Muslim asylum seekers.
Apparently, you have to be white and Christian to be treated properly by the European Union. That's the sad reality, and it's totally unacceptable. We cannot discriminate according to religion, nationality, or color, which are all things which we don't choose. What we can choose is to be human and to have solidarity with each other.
Drowning by the dozens in Calais, France. Freezing to death in Poland. Packed into camps in Italy, building steel fences, denying basic sanitation, fear-mongering about refugees election after election. The long-running European refugee crisis has taken a new turn, and yet standard European policy remains mostly unchanged. An outcry is growing for the European Union to extend their unity, and many say their humanity, towards non-white refugees.
We have to receive refugees and give them normal, humane conditions, regardless of what continent they come from. We have seen acts towards refugees on the Polish border, and we can't allow such things to happen in France. The government has to treat all refugees with total equality and with urgent measures like proper lodging.
Many say the open discrimination, which reveals a deep racism and xenophobia, as well as an arrogant hypocrisy, will ultimately stain the European Union around the world and at home. Many in the French media are describing Ukrainian refugees as somehow qualitatively superior to other asylum seekers. However, many hope that the European Union realizes soon that all refugees are equal and deserving of dignity, assistance, and the same rights without discrimination. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
When it comes to NATO support and American leadership, we have better ask Afghans. They have the experience of 20 years of Western forces presence in their country. Afghans had counted on Western powers at the beginning, but what the U.S. and its allies really brought for Afghanistan?
Betrayal, definitely. The U.S. and its allies' presence led our country to gallop backward. However, they failed in Afghanistan and ruined our country. We didn't gain anything from dealing with the West except destruction, poverty, and many, many crises.
Sayed Bakir Kazemi was an advisor to the former Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani. He believes Ghani's government easily collapsed because he trusted the U.S. and relied on NATO forces.
It is obvious and historically proven that any government or administration that trusted the U.S. or relied on the West ended up with failure and downfall. This experience is repeated in many countries. Former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani did the same mistake and faced a bad downfall.
Some Afghan experts also blame crisis in Ukraine on the U.S., saying nations are falling victim to the U.S. policies of creating war and terror.
The U.S. is using Ukrainians for its own benefits. Western powers don't care about the collapse and destruction of a nation or government. They follow their own devil policies. Afghanistan's experience is repeating in Ukraine. I hope Ukrainians' leaders learn from Afghanistan's disaster and crisis ends in their country.
After 20 years of invasion, the U.S. and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan in mid-August last year. Today, the country is dealing with the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Afghans are critical of U.S. policies and its legacy on their soil. They consider trusting the U.S. as a big mistake that no country should ever make it. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
British Muslims massed outside Pakistan's High Commission in London, condemning sectarian killings of the country's Shia minority. The vigil comes after a suicide bomber struck inside a Shia Muslim mosque in the northwestern city of Peshawar during Friday prayers last week, killing around 60 worshippers and wounding some 196 people.
The attack may have taken place thousands of miles away, but the pain and hurt that has been felt has resonated across the Muslim world. As you can see behind me, well over 100 people have turned out here today to not only send their thoughts and prayers back to Pakistan, but also to vent their anger and fury at the fact that these types of attacks are still taking place even now.
Daesh claimed responsibility for the attack. The terror group has threatened more violence against Pakistan's Shia. But these worshippers issued strong words of their own.
Shias are like a seed. You bury one and it sprouts out a million more. And they can continue to do whatever they're doing. And I look into their eyes right now and I say, you continue to do what you're doing, but you will never succeed in ending the Shia of Imam Ali, alayhi salam.
We shouldn't have to live in fear that if we go to pray on a Friday, we won't come back. We should know that we're safe and that we're able to do all of this freely. And I want everybody to understand this, that we're taking action because this has happened several times and this needs to stop.
If becoming a creature like you is called being a Muslim, then I think I'm fine with the religion that I stand with. And I think I'm all of these people that are here also stand with me.
Friday's attack was the deadliest in the country since 2018, when 149 people lost their lives, including 9 children, in a terrorist explosion at an election rally in Balochistan. With more than one sectarian terrorist group active in Pakistan, many fear these bloodthirsty bombings will continue to plague Pakistan's religious minorities. Robert Carter, London.
waiting until the final moment to register in order to skirt laws on equal media time for election candidates, French President Emmanuel Macron confirmed he will run for re-election. The slate of candidates is now finalized. Macron began his term hailed as the new leader of the free world, but his once-in-a-century repression of the Yellow Vests has many calling him a liberal strongman who enforces rubber bullet liberalism. Macron is leading in the first round and has a comfortable lead in the second round of roughly 60-40 over far-right mainstay Marine Le Pen. The Russian special military operation in Ukraine has given Macron a 5-point increase in the past 2 weeks, and the ending of extremely strict coronavirus rules in mid-March may lead to another increase. However, Western polling agencies have become severely discredited in recent years, with France's largest newspaper refusing to run any of them.
I don't believe the polls, which are all conducted by private companies who deliver the results, which they are paid to deliver. Macron's track record is catastrophic. He's achieved nothing for the average person. It's truly the dictatorship of a total capitalist. France has really reached the bottom.
The campaign hasn't been centered around the incumbent's record, but openly Islamophobic ideas. Despite running third or fourth in the polls, far-right convicted racist Eric Zemmour has been allowed by media executives to set the agenda.
The rise of the extreme right is totally insupportable, and we have no choice but to confront these ideas of fascism, racism, and xenophobia. France must stand up as one and say no. I'm sure that France will, and I'm sure no far-right candidate will reach the second round.
The resulting lack of serious issues appears certain to produce record abstention. Just 52% of France is interested in the vote this year, compared to 78% for the previous election.
3 weeks ago, all of the leading candidates were openly pro-Russian, but France's media has been swept by a wave of war hysteria, which usually benefits the incumbent. However, for many, at least that has pushed Islamophobia off the agenda, at least for now. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
On Saturday, over 30,000 people staged a rally in the Italian capital against the escalating war between Russia and Ukraine. The initiative was called by trade unions, leftist groups and pro-peace movements as fighting rages on in a number of Ukrainian cities and talks between Kyiv and Moscow have produced very little so far. The protesters chanted slogans for peace and the end of all wars, urging the United Nations to do more to mediate between Russia, Ukraine and all parties related to the ongoing Ukrainian crisis.
Rather than investing in social welfare, labor, health and education systems, in Western countries have been wasting resources on armaments. Today, Russia must be held accountable for the Ukraine crisis.
Anti-war rallies have been held across Italy over the past days. Most of the demonstrations held in Rome, Palermo, Milan and other Italian cities have been in solidarity with Ukraine.
People at the rally have mixed feelings over who should be held accountable for the war in Ukraine. The majority believe there is a shared responsibility upon all the parts involved, from the US and the NATO to Russia's President Vladimir Putin.
In Italy, the most recent government update places the number of Ukrainian refugees who have entered the country since the start of the war at about 9,000. According to Ukrainian-Italian associations, up to 800,000-900,000 refugees may reach Italy in the coming weeks. Max Civili, Rome.
Head of the UN atomic watchdog, Rafael Grossi, was once again in Tehran in less than 3 months to resolve what he called important obstacles in the way of concluding the Vienna talks, which are ongoing between Iran and the P4+1, with the aim of reviving the 2015 deal. In a joint presser, Grossi and head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, said they agree on a roadmap to resolve all the IAEA questions about Iran's nuclear program by late June.
It's a real pleasure to be back in Iran, in Tehran, and with President Islami. with whom we had a very fruitful and intense exchange this morning.
We have agreed to provide the IAEA by June 21st with documents related to outstanding questions between Tehran and the agency.
The IAEA has been seeking answers from Iran on traces of uranium it has allegedly found in old Iranian nuclear facilities. Falling in the category of the safeguards issues, this topic seems to be a major sticking point, blocking an agreement in the ongoing Vienna talks. And as Grossi described, it's intertwined with the fate of the discussions in Vienna.
They are very closely interrelated, and it would be difficult to believe or to imagine that such an important return to such a comprehensive agreement like Barjam would be possible if the agency and Iran would not be seeing eye to eye on how to resolve these important safeguards issues.
Iran has vehemently dismissed the IAEA's safeguards narrative as a political claim, calling on the nuclear watchdog to stick to its technical task and avoid being influenced by, quote, political lobbying.
I urge Mr. Grossi that political influence and lobbying should not impact the decisions of the IAEA. Iran and the IAEA should follow their issues in a completely professional way and behave within the framework of expertise.
Grossi's visit to Tehran is seen as a major push to sort out the last differences in the Austrian capital, which has hosted numerous rounds of talks to remedy the crippled 2015 deal. In 2018, then-U.S. President Donald Trump pulled Washington out of the accord and reinstated sanctions against Iran. Tehran, in return, scaled back its compliance with part of the agreement.
Both Grossi and the Iranian atomic chief agreed that their meeting was fruitful. This could mean that another roadblock has been removed, and negotiators in Vienna will only have to cross the T's before a final conclusion is reached. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
EU foreign affairs ministers held yet another emergency meeting on Friday evening in Brussels to take stock of many Ukraine-related issues. The flow of refugees into EU nations was discussed at length. The impact of recently announced Western sanctions on Russia was assessed.
We are not under regime change. The sanctions are not in order to provoke a regime change in Russia.
Borrell says the sanctions are in fact designed to end the deadly conflict. NATO foreign ministers also met on Friday and reaffirmed their stance of not being drawn into the war. They acknowledged the results could be catastrophic. However, NATO allies continue to send thousands of additional troops into eastern parts of the 30-nation alliance.
And we have over 130 jets at high alert and over 200 ships from the high north to the Mediterranean.
Experts say the US is controlling all of the West's next moves, and the decision to supply deadly arms to Ukraine was a mistake.
The Europeans are saying to the Ukrainian, we're not going to send men to fight with you, we're not going to fight by your side, we give you weapons for you to fight. And had that not happened, President Zelensky would have talked to Russia from day one and avoided this war.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken attended all of the key events in Brussels on Friday, focusing on Ukraine.
Unfortunately, tragically, horrifically, this may not be over soon. And so these efforts that we're making together, we have to sustain them.
A number of political commentators are saying this crisis could have been averted if Russia's legitimate security concerns had been listened to. Therefore, they suggest the onus is now on Western leaders to bring about de-escalation as a matter of urgency. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Limelight.
the racist undertones and overtones of much Western coverage, with commentators and interviewees regularly stressing how Ukrainian refugees are European, civilized, blonde-haired, and blue-eyed, is hard to miss, says Jonathan Cook, journalist, in an article published under the heading Russia-Ukraine. Western media are acting as cheerleaders for war. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. The battlefield is well known for becoming quickly enveloped in the fog of war. That is one reason why inexperienced journalists are cautioned by their editors to wait for evidence and to be alert to propaganda. In practice, however, one can assess where the media's sympathies lie, concealed behind flimsy claims of objectivity, by noting when and for whose benefit these caution rules are abandoned and which sites' narratives are accepted quickly and uncritically. In the West Asia region, it is clear that U.S., European, and Israeli regime claims are all too readily amplified, even when their veracity is in doubt. Such media-fueled lies have been manifold. That the Zionist regime urged the Palestinians it expelled in 1948 to return home. In the case of Ukraine, a similar pattern appears to be emerging. Therefore, widespread, insightful, and entirely fictitious reports in the Western media of Russian troops butchering a contingent of 13 Ukrainian troops on Snake Island in the Black Sea. A fake audio tape was released of the Ukrainians supposedly cursing the Russian invaders. Ukraine's government promised each of them a Hero of Ukraine award, but in fact, it was Russian media reports that were true. There were 82 Ukrainian troops, and they had surrendered. All were alive and well. In another example, a clip from a video game was widely promoted as a heroic lone Ukrainian fighter pilot dubbed the Ghost of Kiev, shooting down Russian planes and helicopters. Misinformation has been shared even more aggressively on Western social media accounts, and most of it is designed to evoke sympathy for Ukraine and hostility to Russia. But what we are seeing is more than just an appetite in the media for evidence-free stories and falsehoods so long as they are directed against Russia. And it is about more than the media's sympathy for Ukrainian resistance denied other groups battling their oppressors, when those oppressors are the West and its allies. The media is chock full of commentators far more rabidly tribal than even Western governments and military generals. The media chorus for more war seems to be serving as an ideological softening up operation, clearing the path for governments as they prepare for more extreme propaganda and undemocratic measures. Along with many others, Mail on Sunday commentator Dan Hodges has been calling for a no-fly zone over Ukraine that even Boris Johnson has rejected for very obvious reasons. It would lead Europe into a direct confrontation with the Russian Air Force and risk confrontation with a nuclear power. Nonetheless, Hodges has described any rejection of this idea as an act of appeasement, no different to appeasement of Hitler in 1938. Russia's invasion came after nearly a decade of goading by the U.S. using NATO as cover to forge ever tighter military relations with its neighbor. Rightly or wrongly, Moscow interpreted NATO's behavior as an aggressive move by the U.S. and its allies into its sphere of influence. The idea that no concession could and can be made to Russia, that the only moral choice, as Hodges calls it, is risking a potential nuclear war, should be understood as the belligerent provocation it clearly is. Condoleezza Rice, an architect of the criminal invasion of Iraq, has not been challenged by the media over her utter hypocrisy in agreeing that when you invade a sovereign nation, that is a war crime. If that is the case, and international law says it is, then Rice herself should be on trial at The Hague.